Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Born through a party in the county jail. The prison band was there and they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard this knocked out jailbird sing that rock.
Everybody, welcome to the Savage Nation. It's heating up out there in the Savage Nation. New York City, the land of my, well, where the graves of my ancestors reside, let's put it to you that way. I had to go back there to see a medical specialist, and I did. Apparently the doctors are different on the east and on the west. And nothing to worry about, but I did get a chance to see some sites in New York, which I'll talk about, including my father's store, still a slum. People pay $1 million to live on that street in some slum. The hipsters are running around with cigarettes in their hands, but the trash bags are still 3 feet high in New York City. The streets stink. I mean, I love New York. I have no idea why people live there, but I love it. It's a great place to visit, as they say. I haven't any idea why real estate is booming in Manhattan. The trash bags are 3 feet high. Black bags of trash, 2 feet away from people sitting in outdoor at outdoor tables having dinner. They don't even see the garbage. The city is dirtier than when I was a kid. See, in my day, there were garbage men in New York City. Garbage men in brown uniforms who went around with trucks and you put your trash out in cans. Nobody threw garbage in the street in black bags. These bags are biodegradable? No. They sit in a landfill for several millennia, I would guess. They never break down. And yet the New Yorkers, who are, oh, so sophisticated when it comes to saving the environment, literally eat, sleep, and drink around garbage. Well, hey, who's to account for a man's taste? I'll tell you more about the trip in a few minutes, including the fact that on the way back, as we approached 43,000 feet cruising altitude in my friend's Gulfstream, we went forward to talk to the pilots and noticed that they had their oxygen masks on. So we assumed it was, you know, a test, like a training thing, because I had just got the turkey sandwich I was going to eat to have a beer. I walk forward, the pilot's mumbling like it looked like a B-29 pilot in a World War II movie. And he screams, "Get your masks on! Get back! It's an emergency! Get your masks on!" And the masks all come dangling down in the seats. Ran back, put the mask on. Mrs. S. started to cry. Young Mr. S. held her hand as the plane went down 10,000 feet. I got out a prayer card. I felt nothing. I don't know what it is. I don't know what's wrong with me. I felt no fear, no joy, no elation. I felt nothing. I don't know if that means I'm crazy. I felt nothing. Is there a psychiatrist in the house? Why did I feel nothing at the thought the plane was going to crash? I didn't think about me. I don't know what it means. I have no idea. But nevertheless, it didn't. Turns out a valve that controls the pressure in the plane jammed up. And we had to go down to a lower altitude to fly home, which we did. No big deal. Could have been a big deal. How do you know what is, right? I spoke to the pilot afterwards, and he told me that the minute it happened, when the valve failed, he didn't know what happened. All he knows is that the pressurization failed, and the plane started to beep. And he said he went to motor memory, and the motor memory is throttle down, nose down, go down to the altitude that you can breathe without a mask. Because, that, you see, that's what you're supposed to do as a pilot. You get down to a level where you can figure out what's wrong with the pressurization when you don't need pressure, you know what I'm saying, and oxygen. But meanwhile, he had the mask on. I thought it was like walking into a B-29, you know, like a movie. You know, tower, kind of emergency. I didn't know what that was going on. Get in your seat. Get the mask on, blah, blah, blah. It's not a big deal. All it did was ruin my ability to have another beer. Because at that point, I didn't want to eat or drink the rest of the flight home. All I wanted to do was get back to San Francisco and my dog. So here I am sitting at my desk. my broadcast desk. The world is good. The bay is good. The birds are good. The dog is good. My dog is underneath the broadcast desk like an RCA Victor dog, a little 10-pound poodle. I mean, he must have missed me because I missed him. Manhattan's just amazing. It's an amazing situation. I love dogs, right? So now, don't take this wrong. I'm sorry. There are too many dogs in Manhattan. I've never seen filth like this in my life. Forget the ladies who used the blue bag from the New York Times for what it was made for. You know, the paper's printed primarily for the ladies in Manhattan to use the blue bag to pick up dog droppings. That we understand. They don't even use a newspaper anymore. They use the blue bag. That's become a very big deal. The price of the paper, what they could do with that Sunday paper, that's for like a big dog. I mean, the Sunday New York Times, you know what I'm saying? They could get a pet horse, a small horse with that one. Train Tracks, which will be out in November, my storybook, right after the election, which I know is going to be a big hit because people are going to be dying to forget the election, does not have this story in it. So I can tell it to you now on the show. It's a true story. So my father has this little store with other, you know, each one has a booth and they sell used goods, antiques, whatever. There's a guy who comes around in an unmarked, like a junky two-door old Plymouth to collect rents in the tenements on that very street because he owned a lot of the buildings down there. At the time, him and his friends did. Then they would collect rents. He'd come around and collect. If they didn't pay, gave him a beating, whatever. And he was a really rough-looking guy. Comes in. But he came in the store, not to shake anyone down. He came in to get away from the mean streets and play pinochle with my my uncle. And here's the funny part. I mean, we all knew who he was. We knew he was one of these people. You know, you're told and they whisper, oh, he's that guy, Jackie, you know, watch out. So you have a respect for the guy because you're afraid of him, right? Even as a kid, but you're looking at him, you figure he's packing heat, he's this, he's that. But he was a rough guy, you could see, built like a little bear. So it never bothered anybody. So he'd come in to play cards with my uncle who had the booth in the front. And they would play cards, I think, rummy or pinochle. I don't know what they're playing. And my uncle was a great guy. He didn't care who the guy was. So he would curse him while they're playing. And this gangster would laugh. He would scream. Let's say the gangster had a better hand than his. He'd throw the hands down. He'd say, you son of a, you know what. And the gangster, who would take no disrespect from anybody, would break into laughter. Why? Because he came in there and let his hair down. He didn't have to walk around with his shell of ego in that place. He could be a regular guy and let the guy he's playing cards with curse him. You follow me? That's part of the story. There's more to it than meets the eye. There's nothing to do with money in that store. I don't see garbage bags in San Francisco. New York has a national, international disgrace. People are paying $68 million for a 10,000-square-foot penthouse, and they walk downstairs and there's garbage bags piled up to their waist. Why is that going on? Why are there garbage bags in the streets of Manhattan, Mayor Bloomberg? I don't understand it. When I was a kid, the streets were cleaner. There were garbage men, New York City Sanitation Department garbage men in brown uniforms, and there were cans. You had to put ash cans out with the garbage in it. When did it originate that you could throw garbage in a plastic bag that's like 4 feet, 6 feet wide, 10 feet high? When did this originate? Where's all this garbage coming from? How do they live with this? How does Bloomberg, who bans a soda, put up with garbage bags in the street? How blind could people be who think they're environmentalists, who know everything about climate science, eat 3 feet away from a garbage bag that's festering in the heat? You know, if you live there, you probably, it becomes part of the landscape and you don't notice, like a boil on your back that's been there for so long you start to ignore it, or like eczema. But if you go there, I haven't been to New York for at least 18 years, by the way. It's a funny thing. When my mother left, moved to Florida, God rest her soul, I never went back. You know, my publishers are in Manhattan, but we do it by phone, email, whatever. My agent's there. I don't go there. So I went there. It's like I never left. That's number one. A lot of things have not changed at all. Everyone thinks everything changed. The museum, the Metropolitan Museum, is the greatest museum in the world. I mean, I could spend weeks in that museum. Thank God there's no garbage in the museum. Just walking through the Greco-Roman exhibit is enough to, like, put everything in context. Going to my favorite nook and cranny. I mean, I went to the Islamic wing of the museum because I wanted to see a certain room I used to go to as a poor young man for serenity. I used to go to this room in the Islamic wing that was there. I asked the guard, blah, 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 go down there, go. There it was, with the trickling fountain. I was just still blown away by the serenity of this room from a house in Syria from the 1920s in the Islamic art wing. It was amazing to see this. So don't think I just see the bad things. I mean, you know, I'm not that negative. Why is the city dirtier than when I was a boy? I haven't been there in 18 years. I'm like the guy. I'm like a visitor from another planet. I'm like the brother from another planet who goes to Manhattan and sees things as they really are. Because when you're in a place day in, day out, you grow up there, you live there. So let's say you live in a really great apartment, condo. You don't see the garbage. It becomes part of the background. It's like ignoring the crime, ignoring the garbage. And I want to know why the garbage is in the streets. It stank in these black bags. It was ugly. It was a unsightly mess. To sit in that, why do they sit in cafe East 69th Street? They're on Madison Avenue having a dinner. The legs are up, swirling the wine. 1 foot away is 3 feet of garbage. They don't notice the garbage? I don't understand this. How does a city degenerate like this? I got to go back to it because there's an awful lot to be said about garbage and what it tells you about a civilization or the lack thereof. I cannot believe that in ancient Rome they let garbage sit in the streets at night. That's number one. I can't believe that the Athenians would have let garbage sit in the streets of Athens 2,000 years ago. I can't imagine that garbage would have piled up at Jerusalem 5,000 years ago. I can't imagine it. And how does it go on in Manhattan is what I want to know. And I want to know why. I want to know why. Because in my day, there were garbage men. Actual New York City Department of Sanitation workers. They wore brown uniforms. You had trash cans. You had to put your trash in the can. You put them out on a certain night. The trash guys came. They threw it in there. That's where they threw Tippy the dog in the garbage truck. Remember that story? No, it's a sad story. But I remember when my dog died, the one who bit me through to the bone, he died of a heart attack. He was like 9 from eating kitchen scraps. The same wonderful cuisine that put away all the men in that neighborhood. I'm a real survivor. If I survived that diet, what I ate, I told you this. Somebody up there must like my arteries because it doesn't make sense. The dog even died from it. The dog died just from the scraps, the father, the grand. Everyone died from that diet. The only people who survived were the women who didn't eat it. Symbol shot. But the dog, he dies at age 8. I come down. My mother's crying. He's stiff as a board. The chow bit me through to the bone a few years before. I was glad he was dead. I was afraid to walk around in my own house. Thank God the monster was dead. It was like a lion died in the house. So he was dead. She was crying. She was a nice woman. We didn't know what to do. She didn't know who to call. She calls the garbage man. I swear to God, an hour later, the garbage truck pulls up. Two guys come in with a somber face like out of The Sopranos. Brown uniforms. They nod like a person was dead. Like a sad, like an undertaker face. Okay, you ready, Joe? And the one grabs the front paws, the other grabs the rear legs, and they carry the stiff out. They press the lever, the truck's going, they're rolling, and they throw the dog in. That was the end of it. No pet cemetery, no crying, no tears, no tombstone. No going there every year with like kennel ration cans, balloons, little clownettes, nothing. In the garbage truck and gone. Why? How do I know why? I don't know. Maybe in those days people didn't think about it as much. You know, I love my dog. I don't know. But there must be something in between a pet cemetery and a garbage truck. I don't know what it is yet. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
I better open the window in here and take deep breaths. I feel I'm going to have an attack in a minute. It was a mess, 8:30 in the morning, ring, ring. I mean, don't worry. Did I wake you? No, I always get up 15 hours before my radio show, you know, the Lenny Bruce line. But I was in a fog. I got up at 6, 5:30, because I always get up, men get up that early. The athletic ones get up, and they do 56 push-ups. They eat some kind of hippie cereal. They run around the block. They save orphans. Me, I go back to sleep. I pull the curtains and make sure I get another 3 hours of sleep because I can't work. Starting later in the day. It's impossible if I'm up that early agitating with the internet. So the dog does his thing in the yard. I do my thing. Da, 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 and we get back into bed. All of a sudden, I finally fell back asleep. It's very hard to go back to sleep. It's an art unto itself. You have to have tremendous self-control. You have to have some presence of mind, by the way, to shut off a mind and go back to sleep. Wow. You have to go through everything that came up. You have to recycle it back down. You know what I'm saying? You have to like, okay, that's fine. I'll handle it. Don't worry. Don't forget to call him because you got to do that. And then for the radio, and Ohio, you're off the air. Huh? And in New York, okay, I'll take care of that. You run through the entire list of things that are played. Don't forget this character, got to do that. In the book, you got to do that. And you're working that book, and that character does that. And I don't want to get up and write it down because the minute I put hand to paper and write down anything that I have thought of, bingo, I'm up. That's it. There's something about the hand-eye coordination with paper that sets off the whole thing. The next thing is coffee.
and Bad Santa for the rest of the day. So I go back to sleep. I'm in a fog. I don't know what I'm dreaming. I'm having a pseudo heart attack. Did you ever get one of those? A lot of guys get it in their 30s. They think they're going to die because they have young families. They're afraid. 20s, they don't feel anything. 30, right, they're near death every day. You know, they're a little gray hair, a little pudge. Right away, every other day they have a quirk. Oh, they're driving in the car. Oh, there it is. They grab. They put, oh, God, there it is. I'm going to leave them. Did I get enough insurance? Can I hear? Can I see? Am I going to die? I don't want to die so young. 2 minutes later, it passes, and they didn't have a heart attack. It was because they ate another holistic breakfast with uncooked items in it. Totally indigestible on a cold day. It's like reverse of anything sane to eat cold, raw things in the morning. But okay, it's the same people. And no mentality about the human being. Basically, it's the same as you're a Neanderthal. Neanderthals were even cooking. And the Neanderthals, so far as I can recall, cooked things. In fact, the separation between man and the beast was the raw and the cooked. Levi Strauss wrote that seminal paper in anthropology, The Raw and the Cooked. And he said that the distinction between the uncivilized and the civilized on Earth is fire and cooking food. So now we wake up in the year 2011 and take a look what we have, raw foods they're eating. They started with the cockamamie story, the enzymes. The enzymes in raw food, but there's no enzymes in cooked food. Who came up with that one? That's like saying, I know how to save you, you know, follow this. It's unbelievable to me. There's no enzymes in cooked food. How do people live for thousands of years, idiot? Okay, so anyway, that's why you have the false heart attacks. It happened to me. I'm trying to tell you a thing. How do you think the false heart attack occurred? So the cardiologist had told me if I ever get a sense that I'm having a heart attack, I said, well, what am I supposed to do? What if it's a false? He says, get 2 chew baby aspirins, chew and swallow them immediately. I said, okay. So I think 2 seconds later, the pain went away. Now, how would I trace it back to? Because I didn't die. It was simple. Last night after working on the radio, I had to edit my book. I had to write my book. I had to read my book. I was up late till 10 o'clock. I went home, and I had skipped dinner. So I figured I was tormented to stop at an Italian restaurant on the way home in the suburbs and grab something. But 10:30 at night, instead of having a hot Italian meal, I would have slept like a baby. What do I eat? I take a bagel. I toast it. I would have been better off with meatballs and spaghetti. I would have slept like a baby.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
So why is there garbage in Manhattan, and why does Mayor Bloomberg get away with talking about soda, banning soda while garbage is piling up? Can anyone explain it to me how the people are that naive? He talks about we're going to ban soda because it's bad for people, but the garbage bags he doesn't even see. Unbelievable. And if you missed the joke, it's not even funny, but it's a joke nevertheless. For those of you who understand, it's not a joke. New York, WOR, Vince, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Mikey, I'm surprised that you don't realize what's going on in the city of New York as far as garbage is concerned. Okay, let me explain something to you. You got 60 bags of garbage outside your house. The truck pulls up nice. They're going to take 30 bags, and you're the superintendent in the building. You're saying, hey, what's going on here? Put the 50 in my hand, and the other 30 bags are going to go in the truck. Otherwise, we'll leave them here until we come two or three days from now. And this is the way it goes on. When there used to be city workers in the city of New York who were garbage men, who were happy to collect a pension and were happy with that, now they've been taken over by friggin' Teamsters.
Wait a minute, I didn't know this. So there is no New York City Department of Sanitation anymore, that is correct?
It's the Teamsters, and they got Bloomberg in their back pocket. Come on, man, don't you see this?
No, listen to me. I was only there for 3 days. So there is no New York City garbage men anymore. It's all private haulers. You mean the Sopranos, the sanitation Sopranos machine?
And that's that.
That's that.
And that's that.
And that's it. And that's the end of the story. So there's your answer, Mr. Bloomberg. Is that why you're focusing on 32 ounces of soda? Yeah, okay. 1-800-449. The guy, you know, he told you like it is. Like I didn't figure it out. I had to let him figure it out. Because, you know, one man's garbage is another man's what, Beowulf? What'd you say? One man's garbage is another man. As Tony Soprano said, one man's garbage is another man's treasure. G-
garbage in, garbage, garbage in, garbage out. But look, let's not focus only on the garbage. Let's see what's good about Manhattan. It was so beautiful, actually, thinking of buying an apartment there, in a way, with the garbage. Because I'm a people watcher. There's no one to talk to in San Francisco. People are mute. Look, there's a beautiful downtown here. Don't get me wrong. The air is gorgeous. The weather's better. The buildings are great. The people are like zomboids. You can't have a conversation here with a stranger. And I'm like a schmoozer guy. I can walk down the street. I could talk to a Nigerian who's here 3 days who speaks English, broken English. I can get a better human contact with a New York guy from Nigeria in Manhattan than I can with a person who's lived in San Francisco his whole life. I never saw anything like it. I've been out here most of my adult life, and it's like talking to a brick statue. You go up and you say anything like a joke. You try to like make a joke. Oh, what are you? They look at you like you're crazy. What are you saying? What's wrong with the people here? I don't understand it. But I came back. I mean, I have a property here. I have all my things here, and I love being here. The weather's gorgeous. And if I stand here on the side of the bay where my studio is, and I see this incredible bay with the air and the birds, it's almost as dramatic as the Manhattan skyline is in its own way. It's a different kind of phenomenon. It's beautiful. And, you know, we have a little museum. Like, I love the De Young, and I love the Palace of the Legion of Honor. We have small collections. But when you go into the Metropolitan, forget the tourists, you know, if they're going to a museum, they're already a different class of people already. Okay, they're not going for the 32-ounce soda, take me out to the Cracker Jack land. God bless you if you like it. So they're French, they're Japanese, whatever, German, and you see a different kind of face walking around the museum. That's number two, because the people in there are part of the thing. But you look at Greco-Roman pieces from thousands of years ago. Here, like an example. They do a sculpting of a very high caste Roman, possibly not an emperor, but near the level of an emperor. One of his it was a legion, the head of a legion, and it's only from his neck to his abdomen and his chest plate, and you could see the side, you know, like the man's chest and all that. It's unbelievable. Or the sculptings of the bodies of the men from Greek or Roman times. It's something to behold. It's incomprehensible what it does to you. There's almost no way to describe it. Or there's another thing. I ought to tell you this. There's a painting, for example. There's a Van Gogh self-portrait that I saw 25 years ago when it was on loan to the museum here in San Francisco. And I wrote about it in my journal that when you stand 3 inches away from this Van Gogh, which has no glass on it, and you stare at it, and you could feel the oil, the brush strokes of Van Gogh. You know, you can feel a man's madness. You can feel his genius. You can feel it coming from the canvas into your eyes. And what's amazing is, you know, there's no glass. The guards aren't afraid that you're going to slash it like you're an occupier. You know what I'm saying? You're not a Democrat. The guy figures, I'm not a Democrat who's going to slash a painting so he didn't, like, come over like a paranoid lunatic. Here in San Francisco, if you go near a painting, even with glass, they want to pull a gun on you. I never saw anything like it. They're like crazy. The whole thing's nuts here. But if you stand next to the Van Gogh self-portrait in the Metropolitan, it's something beyond description. There's no words for it. And then there's like the Islamic room from the 1920s, Damascus, the Serenity. I remember I used to go in there as a poor young man with the stained raincoat with the tuna fish sandwich that I would take as I rode the subway into work. And I'd go into that museum. It was like a break. I felt like a wealthy man. See, that's the thing. Let me conclude it with something that's well known but hasn't been said often enough. You could be a poor man in Manhattan, and you're a very rich man if you actually dip into the culture that's there, right? And you could be a very wealthy man in other parts of the world and be very impoverished because there's nothing there to feed your soul. Now, somebody once said living well is the best revenge. Now, what living well means is up to you. To me, it's a few people I can talk to and have a meal with, which is very rare in this world. So last night, I got to tell you, as I told you I would, a man in the street story. I go up to North Beach Restaurant. Lorenzo had been away for 10 days. And I brought Teddy in. Teddy likes to dine on Italian food. And I go up there and I said, look, I don't want any fish. I don't want any pasta. I want meat tonight. So he says, why don't you have scotto ditto? I said, what's scotto ditto? I don't speak Italian. He says, scotto ditto, it means you'll burn your finger. I said, what? I don't want to burn my finger. He said, no. Scotto ditto means lamb chops. That's how we used to say it in Italy. He said, scotto ditto. So I said, okay, then give me some hot lamb chops. So I ate these greatest lamb chops. Teddy scoffed down some veal at Lorenzo. Lorenzo just lost one of his dogs, and he was heartbroken, so he likes Teddy more than ever. And he gave him some veal.
And we had a nice time. And I'm leading up to some wine here, some wine story. I bring in a bottle of my own because I had been drinking earlier the night before New Zealand wine. I happen to like wine. When I drink wine at all, I like New Zealand from Marlboro, the Sauvignon Blanc from Marlboro in New Zealand, right? And it's a little bit of an affront to Lorenzo because he has his own, you know, vineyard. I understand that. But it's all right. He's a big guy. So he drank the wine. And he said to me, the first thing that you smell when you drink it, well, I don't know. Do you want to hear more about wine? Because his grandfather taught him in Italy how to taste wine when he was 6 years old. Here's what his grandfather said. He said, Lorenzo, you take a small sip of wine. You put it on your tongue. Don't move anything. Count to eight and let it go down from the side of your mouth into your throat. And then he said, as a young kid, he choked almost to death from it. He said, when he did it, though, I experienced it because the side of your mouth is the most delicate part of your throat. I experienced something incredible. Something incredible because it goes all the way into your throat and the side of your mouth. My grandfather used to say, you know when you do that, it takes the pants off the wine and you really see what is there. I love the florid language of old Italy. So I'm going to give you a little more of the florid language of old Italy. You ready for more? Here's some more. They had a lot of troubles in Italy after the war. So he says his grandfather told him when he was a little boy in Italy, when they had nothing but trouble because the Nazis had occupied Italy, by the way, his grandfather said to him, everyone has a cross to bear, but lucky is the one that can keep the cross in his pocket. That struck me as such a brilliant statement to remember. I love that one, so I made a note of it. And then we talked about olive oil and this and that. I'm not going to bore you with that, but here's the end of the story because it was very funny. I ate the meal. Teddy had his meal. We had a lot of fun talking. I drank some wine. I go outside. It turned very cold. It was like 50 degrees, 51 degrees. The wind was blowing, which I love. I had my overcoat and hat on. And just guys, you know, BSing in the street waiting to get back in the car. Incidentally, someone drives me when I drink. You just should know that in case you want to send a letter to somebody. And then a man comes around the corner, an Iranian man. He's a Persian. He owns a Persian restaurant around the corner. I've seen the restaurant for 30 years. I've not gone in it. It's always been known as a upscale, you know, Persian restaurant. But I never went in it. So he says to me, did I tell you a story? He says, I know who you are. He says, you're a legend in this city. And he says to me, I said, thank you very much. I said, well, your restaurant is a legend. We exchange pleasantries. So he said to me, did I ever tell you? Now, remember, he's a Muslim. So he says to me, did I ever tell you the story that when the Jews don't eat, the Muslims starve to death? Well, we all broke into phenomenal laughter. I said, that's the funniest thing I ever heard. He was, of course, referring to the days of the Jewish holidays when Jewish people generally don't go to restaurants. So here is a Muslim guy who owns a Persian restaurant. He says, we have a saying in the restaurant business that when the Jews don't eat, the Muslims starve to death. I said, I got to say that on the radio tomorrow. He says, no, no, no. He says, you can't say it because you're not Muslim. He says, people will take offense. He said, let me say it. I can't imagine a Muslim would take offense at something that's funny. I mean, it's a good-natured joke, isn't it? Or did that offend somebody? Maybe you can call the ACLU because I told you a joke. San Luis Obispo, Robbie, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. I hear you talk about olive oil. I'm an old retired surgeon who makes olive oil in California, and I know you like Spanish oil, but there are some pretty spectacular California olive oils that are really, really extra virgin.
Oh, I almost drink it. I use a California or extra virgin olive oil because it's about the only certified organic oil that's reliably organic.
Yeah, we really police ourselves. The California Olive Oil Council, we have the highest standards in the world for the certification as extra virgin. And one
I really, believe me, I'm an olive oil fanatic, and I do love, yes, I like Spanish olive oil, but the fact of the matter is there are trees here in California that are not quite 1,000 years old, but they're some phenomenally old trees. And if they're new trees, they're made from cuttings from Spanish cuttings, weren't they, some of them?
Some of them, yes.
But, yes, and the reason I like Spanish olive oil in general is because it's a lower acid oil. Am I correct in that?
It is, but we make a very unique varietal from Italy that's also very, very low in acidity. And one of these days I'd love to get you to try it.
Let me ask you something. My friend Lorenzo at North Beach Restaurant has a vineyard. I was there when he cut down the trees and put in his vineyard. So I asked him why his oil is amazing from his vineyard up. You probably are familiar with it, Petroni oil. So I said, well, what are your olive trees from? He said, the trees are from, the cuttings are from Tuscany, and they're a mixture of, listen to this, Lacino, Pendolino, Moraiolo, Coratina, and Frantoio, which he says is the classical Tuscan blend. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Hey, what are you talking about garbage for? The Scongeli Hauling Company does a great job in Manhattan. You don't like the bags? That's your problem. Don't be talking about no garbage. The Scongeli Hauling Company does a good job. That's all you got to know. The mayor talks about soda for a reason. We tell him what to talk about.
You know, in the peak of your life, when you're 45, 50, you think that you're indestructible. You're going to live forever. You go to a museum like the Metropolitan, you see a tomb of an emperor or a statue of a guy who lived thousands of years ago, who's, of course, not even Adam. He's dust now. What is that? Humbles you. See, great art is like religion. That's the point I'm trying to make. I'm fundamentally a spiritual man, not a religious man. But great art to me is very spiritual in the sense that it humbles you, in that you understand that you're finite, number one, and that you shouldn't be too proud, because at the end of it all, what are you? So the guy who's 50, 45 in the prime of his life, full of energy, laughs at the other guy, you know, abuses people, robs them, whatever. Now get back to me when he's like whatever age, whenever it hits, and there he is, abandoned in the nursing home by the family, can't move, in the chair, in the corner, next to the curtain, drooling on himself, staring at a curtain, and he's beaten about the head and neck for the change that his children leave him when they visit him once a month by the third worlder who they hire in the nursing home, and that's the end of his life, even though at one point he was this big, powerful guy in the Mercedes on East 76th Street going into the restaurant that Sinatra ate in. Not a bad run. Not a bad run. I can still do it. That's why I'm listening to. I got to do this once in a while. Get it out of my system. Let me tell you a funny hat story in Manhattan. It's a funny side story. It might be funny if you understand the mores of the streets of Manhattan, which apparently I forgot because I've been gone so long, I'm like a rube. So I go out to dinner one of the nights with my my agent and a couple of publishers. It was a nice dinner in some uptown restaurant. I didn't care for the food, honestly. I'm not into these long, you know, but it was jammed. I'm talking about 500 people packed. I don't know whether it was a restaurant that Sinatra ate in. The place I wanted to get into, this is a funny story, a secondary story. There was only one Italian restaurant I wanted to eat in, which nobody can get into. Even the owner can't get into it. It's so small. It's in the, you know, like 100 and whatever, 20th Street. Everybody, every entertainer, every wise guy thing, everybody wants to eat. I got their cookbook. I used their sauce. I wanted to go there. So this publisher publishes their cookbook and couldn't get in. And the owner says, I'm a fan of Michael Savage, but he couldn't give me a table. Can you believe this? That was the only Italian restaurant I wanted to eat in. I couldn't get in. So I went where he wanted to go, whatever. Truthfully, I'd rather get a chicken from Safeway most nights and talk to my dog and watch the news and go on a bike ride and look at a seagull. But, okay, you go to the restaurant, jam, the meal, till it came, you could faint. And it's such a fancy Italian restaurant that they don't even serve bread. Now you understand how expensive it's going to be. There's not a piece of bread on the table. Not even. And this was so expensive, there wasn't even a breadstick. See, the more expensive, the less food, of course. And it's so déclassé to have bread, they don't have it. And even a breadstick is a mark of a cheap Italian restaurant. The real death knell is a meatball, which is the only thing I wanted to eat, but they didn't have. So I ordered something I didn't want, and I ate it. And my fingers were like, the hands didn't work in the bed at night. I couldn't move the wrist or the hand. I suspect either it was a high salt content or some dipping thing that they did in the kitchen or some extracted sauce that some schmendrick came up with from a cooking school that must add 600 grams of salt, you know, per milliliter. I'll tell you exactly what I wore. It's an outfit I like. I wore a black velour jacket, which I love, because wherever I go, no matter where I am, it looks good. It's like a retro. Everyone thinks it's retro, but then the guys look at you and say, God, I wish I had one. You know what I mean? I bought it a few years ago, but it was a big thing from the 70s. This was a new one. So I wear it at night wherever I go. Florida, here, everyone loves it. Women love this jacket, black velour. And I have a striped, like, plum purple shirt with a purple tie. Very cool, nice pants, dark pants, whatever. And I have a hat, which you've seen on the cover of Psychological Nudity, if you bought that book. It's a gray Gucci hat, like a little hat, small hat. I don't wear it for effect. I think it's a beautiful hat, and I wear it particularly when it is sun out. I don't want sun on my head, but I don't want to wear a goofy hat. I don't want to wear a cowboy hat. I don't want to wear a cowboy hat and look like Midnight Cowboy. I don't want to wear a big hat or a dumb hat or a liberal hat or, you know, a floppy hat. So it's like a kind of like nice singer's hat. So, okay, wear it in the street. That's okay. I go in the restaurant, and I had it on my head. Even though it was nighttime, the sun was still out. The burning sun, I had it on. Go in, sit down, eat the meal. It's 2 hours later. As I'm leaving, I forgot to add the hat. I put it on my head. As I'm walking out, I didn't even realize I had my hat on until four guys who were right out of The Sopranos start pointing at me and mocking me and laughing. Like, who's that schmuck with the hat on? Who's he think he is? I saw it in 2 seconds because I grew up in New York. It was like being in high school again, you know, with the bullies. I didn't give a damn. I'm so disconnected from social interaction and from caring about who says what that I didn't even get offended by it. Thank God I didn't. I would have wound up in the back of a garbage truck. I didn't even get offended. I looked at them and pointed and said, thank you. That's all I said as we walked out of the restaurant. Then I realized they were mocking my hat because I was wearing a hat like I was a big shot or I was trying to be cool. And they were right in the way. Who wears a hat in a restaurant? That's all. Even on the Upper East Side, there's trash bags, but no one sees that. They walk around it. Is it like this in Paris? Is it like this in all of the West? Is this a mark of the decaying Western civilization, the garbage bag? With all the progress and all the liberals and all of the concern with the environment, it's filthier than when I was a boy. How's that? Write it down. Let me repeat it in case you missed it. With all of the 50 years of brainwashing about the environment and the ecology and global warming, and we got to clean up the environment and ban soda and ban cigarettes and ban fat and ban popcorn and ban salt, Mayor Bloomberg lets the garbage pile up 4 feet high in the streets of Manhattan. How does that work?
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I get in the studio. Generally, I drink black tea before the show. It's a gluten-free black tea. That's a joke. Gluten-free schmucks. I want gluten-free. They don't even know what gluten is. They think it's like a religious thing. They're like kosher rabbis. Is it kosher? Yes, it's gluten-free. Oh, I'll have it. What's gluten? They don't know what gluten is, but they know it's no good. That's the latest hula hoop of the health world. Gluten-free. Schmendrix. They don't know the first. Global warming. We're all dying from heat. Caused by mankind. And so therefore I need a gluten-free diet. All night long they're putting drugs in their system and sleeping with a fraternity house. In the morning they're vegetarians, lacto-vegetarians, and gluten-free. They're clean as a whistle the next day. I don't want to talk about it. What are they calling me on? Oh, the accidents. I come into the studio. I generally drink tea before the show. I boil water. I make the black tea. I carry the teacup downstairs to my radio studio. This is a home studio. And for some reason, I was distracted thinking about the show. I'm very off base in my mind today from yesterday. I couldn't sleep all night. I had delirium all night. I was like in bed with delirium from yesterday's ruling. Delirium. We've turned the road. We've crossed the Rubicon. We've passed the tipping point. The bakery bread is stale. The meat has gone bad. The kosher butcher has been found out to be a Nazi. It's all bad. Everything's wrong. I spilled my tea into the keyboard. An entire cup on my pants, on my green felt tabletop, on my studio top, into the keyboard, the HP pad. Teddy jumps. I get a towel. I turn the HP keyboard upside down. I drain it. And God bless American technology. It worked. It was like the Volkswagen and Woody Allen's 1960s movie. It started 100 years later. So I'm sitting here basically in my shorts. I swear to God. I'm sitting in the radio studio in an undershirt with a half a cup of tea doing this show. I mean, life is really actually maddening, to be honest with you. God, tea is the greatest drink on the planet. I don't know. Whatever's wrong with me, it stabilizes me. It just it balances out the whole something to do with whatever. It's probably the tannic acid, the high tannic levels in the tea that have something to do with the stability, mental stability. I am Michael Savage. I am an enigma within an enigma. This is an article that came out in Gentry magazine written by a writer who interviewed me named Steve Travers, where he says he has just published another bestseller. He is one of the most powerful voices in media and politics, yet he is a misunderstood loner. How did a hardcore conservative abandon Britain for being too far to the right, come from a youth influenced by and spent with the counterculture of Timothy Leary? He tells it like it is brusque and hard to like, yet underneath the rough exterior is a polite, formal man even his listeners didn't know until now. I don't know that I'm that hard to like. My dog likes me. I don't understand where that came from. My dog loves me. And by the way, I didn't spend the youth with Timothy Leary. I met him once for 5 minutes. But I guess that sells magazines. I met Timothy Leary for 5 minutes. They make that a youth spent with Timothy Leary. I spent the youth in my father's antiques market wearing dead man's pants. That was my youth. Now it's suddenly turning on Tim Leary. I went to the Millbrook Estate once. I was his gatekeeper for a day. Because I was the only one who wouldn't use LSD, never have, never will. And I already have spent my youth with him. This is not badly written, to be honest with you. Let me read you a paragraph or two, then I'll let you go. Paranoia the Destroyer. The lyrics come from a band Dr. Savage apparently likes because he uses a song by the Kinks, Living on a Thin Line, about the fall of British greatness. Dr. Savage is paranoid. There are mighty forces arrayed against him. Shadowy conspiracies, enemies plotting his demise and all he holds dear. He does not want his picture taken. He calls you. You do not call him. His phone number is blocked. He does not want his email address shown to anybody. Nobody knows what his wife looks like. He owns several residences and rotates where he lives, apparently to confuse those who might seek to harm him. Where he broadcasts from is a mystery. Oh, one more thing. His paranoia is totally valid. This is a man who, if his descriptions are only 50% accurate, is the most qualified man not to be hired by academia. A man who once had his home address broadcast on air by a radical left-winger who told his listeners to go to his house and make life bad for his family. This is a man targeted by Islamic thought police at the height of the war on terrorism, considered enemy number one by political factions trying to get the FCC to institute a fairness doctrine, forcing him off the air. Fired from a TV gig at MSNBC after about 10 seconds. Because he failed to bow at the altar of the left-wing lobby, which views him about the way a certain sailor named Ahab viewed a certain large white mammal of the seas, is considered an official enemy of all minorities, the sacred cows of modern American politics, lives with an entire political party, the Democrats, who, if left to their own devices, would all go to Pol Pot. On him, is barely more tolerated by the Republican establishment, is persona non grata on Fox News, left out of the fraternity of conservative talk show hosts, and oh, one last thing, is actually banned from America's best friend. And, oh, I swear to God, the tea again. I'll be right back. Oh my God, this is crazy.
Savage.
Of the stories in the Bible about folks like Abel and Noah, folks like Abraham and Sarah, and the verse in Hebrews that says, all these people were still living by faith when they died.
Yeah.
They did not receive the things promised. And today...
Yeah, they're suffering. You know, Michelle and Obama are suffering. I mean, they're suffering. They're really suffering. You know, Air Force One is a stress. White House is a stress. Compared to Oprah Winfrey's place, the White House is a dump. You know, I mean, Air Force One is nothing to them. They're suffering. They didn't receive their due yet. They're worth much more than what they have. When they're king of the world, king and queen of the world, then they will perhaps receive God's blessings on this earth. But right now, they're still struggling. They're still marching with their heads held high, trying to right the wrongs of the oppressed. Astounding. I'm a shunned figure in the media, yet I have a very powerful radio show, and I'm a best-selling author over and over again, says Dr. Savage. I'm reading from the article. He is brusque, hard to like, pushy, very impatient, then seconds later formally polite and cooperative to a fault. He suffers fools badly, is easily exasperated and put upon, then just as quickly, efficiently fulfills all requests. At once he protests that he has no time, then gives of his time with generosity of spirit. He is very shy, yet robustly self-important, with a huge ego he readily admits to and says he could not succeed in his profession without. He is right. He hides details of his life. Then a few hours later on the air, lets it all hang out for millions of listeners. He then says, Rome of the New Republic. Everyone walked around knowing that New York was the center of the world and that America was the center of the world. New York was the center of the center, Dr. Savage says, of his childhood as Michael in the Bronx and Queens. That was the attitude then. My father, in his little store, I mean, without using words such as honor, told me never to cheat on anyone, and if somebody didn't like something, take the object back and give them their money back. That kind of thing, Savage recalls. He never lectured about honor. He just had honor in his life. As a young age, Dr. S. was motivated to write when he read about a vivacious French teenage girl who wrote a blistering bestseller that sold enough for her to buy a black XK120 Jaguar. Jack Kerouac influenced him. He was the same type of character as Savage. Introspective, loner, outsiders, but not shunning action when necessary, whose influence on him was extended later in his writings in Marin County, California, a faraway land that Dr. Savage romanticized as a place where deer, unheard of in Queens, New York, wandered into backyards. Like Kerouac, his brother died young. Savage beatified his own saintly brother, Jerome, who also passed tragically. Ernest Hemingway's heroic characters further shaped the young man. Again, there was a sheen of bravado in his persona that appealed to me greatly as a young man. The safaris, women in the tent, the khaki clothing, you know what I'm saying. That kind of whole imagery, of the heroic imagery, there was another aspect of their influence. Now remember, a lot of those guys in that era, whether they be Hemingway, Kerouac, or Henry Miller, they were all heavy, heavy drinkers. And they boasted about being alcoholics, he says. There was a nobility in Hemingway's writing and a nobility in his characters. The heroic male who was usually, like Kerouac, a loner, usually misunderstood, somewhat introverted, or shall I say introspective, was extremely appealing to me because it matched my character. So I was drawn to that same type of personality. I'm reading from the interview. Actually, these are good quotes. It is in many ways the key to his success. Like Kerouac, the misunderstood outsider who shuns much of the material trappings his success has brought him in favor of pedestrian pleasures, good spaghetti, cold beer, a great movie on television. He is an everyman who is also so complex, his life story should be a full-length biography, a documentary, maybe even a movie if Hollywood would dare, which they will not. Just as influential was Henry Miller. Quote, and if you read Black Spring, you read one of the greatest books ever, Savage read and reread it when he was stranded in Fairfax, California for many years. Allen Ginsberg was the devil, the rabbinic figure, Jewish voice, Jewish name, right? Deep, sonorous voice. He was devil incarnate, probably one of the most evil men in modern American history, like a Rasputin of the literary world. I thought he was kind of a demigod rabbi. Kerouac hated Ginsberg as the devil incarnate, said he misled him in his early life, says Savage. Well, read Kerouac. Influenced also by A. E. Housman's dark poetry, a Shropshire lad similarly affected him. When I was 1 and 20, I heard a wise man say, give crowns and pounds and guineas, but give not your heart away. Give pearls away and rubies, but keep your fancy free, he read from memory. But when I was 1 and 20, no use to talk to me. How's that for a poem? So I read poetry in a previous life type of thing. Not unlike one of Dr. Savage's heroes, General George Patton. No one's ever heard of the Housman story. That's an important part of this interview, continues Savage. That's because as a young man who had a sense of mortality, I was going through the sufferings of young angst, where you overemphasize your own value, where we're all so tragic because we're going to die one day, right? The beatniks began America's degeneracy, which Savage says destroyed America's psyche, and it was a troika. It was Allen Ginsberg, Timothy Leary, and in the legal sphere, he made the law into a mockery. It was William Kunstler. The women's movement was based on hatred of the male, which shifted the nation from optimism and production into something entirely different. Looking over your shoulder, questioning yourself, doubting the history of the nation, that's the result of only a very few people, a handful of left-wing revolutionaries. I'm continuing on this great interview about me, myself. Shall I continue? I need to know what you want to do. You want me to talk about this, that, this interview? Because it's a long interview. It goes on forever. There's only a bit of it. I'll take a call or two. How's that? Matt in Nebraska, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Man, the myth, the legend, Michael Savage. I'm looking for some life coaching advice from you.
Well, what do you mean? What's your problem?
Well, I'm a 24-year-old. I'm sitting here in Nebraska. And for the first time, I'm wondering what and where to go and what to do with
well, that's the beginning of your road. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong. It's the doubt that impels you. There's nothing wrong with you. Now you got to go out and fail a few times to find out what you really are good for, or really what you're not good for, and find out what life is all about. And if you really want to have something to motivate, you get married along the way, have two children, and be broke and work four jobs. I guarantee you'll figure it out then. Joking. Well, go out. I mean, you're trying to figure out what to do, right? So go out and do anything that you think about doing.
Well, here's the thing, Doctor. I joined the National Guard for multiple reasons, and figuring that would be a good move. And I just find out I'm on TRICARE right now, which is the military health care benefits. And I just find out that, you know, that's going to be under attack by Obama himself. And
so again, what is it you're asking me? Should you leave the National Guard? I don't know exactly what the question is. I can't even answer you unless I know what the problem is. You want to leave the military and start out on another road?
I'm not saying there's necessarily a problem, Doctor. What I'm asking is, if you're 24 years old, young, charming, handsome, what would you do in these times?
Meet as many women as I could, as fast as I could, and have as much fun as I could.
All right. That's good enough for me, Doctor.
Okay. Hey, have a good weekend. I know I won't. I mean, I remember when I was 23, 24. So, you know, a doctor told me a funny joke the other day. He says to me, from ages 18 to 25, all a man thinks about is sex. From age 25 to 50, all a man thinks about is money. From age 50 and on, he said, all he thinks about is whether he can go to the bathroom. I said, well, okay, forget about it. I don't want to hear that joke. So let me continue a little bit more here and there. The beatniks began America's degeneracy, which Savage says destroyed America's psyche. Then I read into that, right? He recalls his education at Queens College then as being better than what left-wing... Wait. He recalls his education at Queens College then as being better than what left-wing ethnic studies majors are receiving at Harvard today. Okay. On top of two master's degrees, botany, medical anthropology, and six academic books, Savage earned a PhD from the greatest university in America, the University of California at Berkeley in 1978. He was married with two young children. He claims he received 200 job rejection letters after getting his PhD. Why, he asks rhetorically? Certainly not because I didn't have the academic credentials. I had committed the greater crime. I was not born a black, a Hispanic, and I was not an illegal or a preferred minority. And I wasn't a woman. Because affirmative action had clicked in where white males need not apply. And I must tell you, Stephen, when you're 36 years old and you've killed yourself to support yourself without scholarships, to get two master's degrees and a PhD, and you have two young children, and you're not hired because you're of the wrong race or sexual orientation, it tends to make you think very hard about your society. And then you find out that society is all twisted. I'll never forget, as long as I live, what the ACLU published in those years, the darkest years of my life. They wrote, some people will have to put their lives on hold so that others may advance. That was the ACLU's writings on the issue of not hiring white males. I think that pretty much defines when I became a conservative. A conservative indeed was born. Today it is impossible not to compare Dr. Savage's own struggles with President Barack Hussein Obama, who roughly during the same period of time, from all indications, rode a wave of affirmative action, scholarships, and preferences all the way from the prestigious Punahou School in Hawaii, Occidental College in Southern California, Columbia and then Harvard Law School, all very expensive private institutions, eventually marrying a woman who also appears to have been given preference to Princeton, where she wrote a thesis essentially claiming that she was up against it because racism made it so hard for blacks, and despite every advantage and opportunity, apparently never felt pride in the greatest nation on earth until it was enlightened enough to nominate her husband for president.
Savage.
Savage.
are listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
There's a moonlight tonight.
And life goes on, that's all. It goes on, it goes on. The sun rises, the sun goes down, the moon turns through its cycles. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you're not going to let it kill you. So the man is dragging us into a kind of soft Marxism, step by step. And there's no opposition party to speak of. You hear a little rumbling here and there, but it's all a plan, both sides. The trees will continue to grow. The birds will continue to tweet. The dogs will continue to bark. The cats will continue to meow. The lions will continue to roar. And so you must go on, that's all. Living well is the best revenge in some ways, but as I told you, sleeping well is an even greater revenge. Unfortunately for me, I didn't sleep last night. Tossed and turned and nightmares. Maybe it was the wine. I started drinking wine again because I don't want to drink beer, which is fattening, and it has gluten in it. That's a joke. No, sorry. I went to one of my restaurants I like, a Basque place. He got some Alsatian white wine. I started drinking, and no headache. I said, okay, I'll drink. So I bought a case of it. Figured, all right, I found white wine again, which I used to love. I lived on it. I drank it like a fish years ago. All of a sudden, last night I drank it. I got so sick from this wine. It was so horrible. It must have been like, it's me. It's the sugars in the wine. I felt like I was drinking like a creamy sugar. It must have been like open. It was open for 2 days, sat in the bottle, pumped up, the whole deal. But I don't know. I had Japanese food. I had like raw fish. Couldn't have been the fish. I don't know what garbage I ate yesterday. Well, it could have been the Indian I had for lunch, too, when you think about it. I ate like a pig yesterday. The anxiety from the show, I indulge. So today you make up for it. So it's like all of the liberals, you know what I'm saying? And they're lacto over vegetarians, gluten-free, they don't touch this. At night they're putting various substances into their nose, sleeping with 40 people. But they eat gluten-free diets the next day to make certain that they're pure. If you could be anybody for 10 minutes of their life, here's an interesting question. One of the posters I keep in one of my studios I am looking at right now, it is a poster of Muhammad Ali standing over Sonny Liston, first round, knocked out Sonny Liston, 1965. It's one of the greatest fight pictures of all time. You got to see Muhammad Ali standing over Liston. You got to see the face of Muhammad Ali. You got to see the grimace on his face after he just locked him on the mat. You got to see the guy's body. Looks like a lion. I mean, it's unbelievable. Look what happened to the poor guy. You know what I'm saying? But wouldn't you love to be him for 10 minutes in that moment? If you could be anyone for 10 minutes, okay, start me off. If I could be anyone for 10 minutes, I'd like to be Muhammad Ali on that day in 1965 in the first round that he knocked out Sonny Liston. At the moment, Sonny hit the canvas, okay? I'd like to be him for 10 minutes. Who would you like to be for 10 minutes and where? That's an interesting question. I'll get no callers on it. I know it's going to get Obamacare, Shmamacare. The tea is everywhere. The whole thing is saturated. The dogs. I go to my studio in San Francisco, right, with Teddy. He was with me all day. He loves the elevator in the building. Up and down. I love there's three elevators in the building. So when I stand in the lobby, I say to him, Teddy, which elevator is coming? Because you can hear the rumbling, right? See? And he likes to put his nose to the floor of the elevator that's going to come. I don't know which one. It's very funny. And he gets it right about 2 out of 3 times, which is very funny. So he loves the elevator. It's nice. Most of the people are nice. Some are real AHs, you know. And he enjoys the city. We like walking around. We see people. I get him burgers. He got a little bit of the runs from the lamb I gave him. I got to admit, dogs can eat lamb, which I found out, by the way, why they're shepherds, because they were allergic to lamb, so they don't eat it. It's an interesting thing. One of the reasons they're shepherds, they don't like eating the animal. They shep. It's like Shep Smith is a shepherd of lies. So I'm in the city. We had a nice day, and I'm coming home early after the show. 8 o'clock, boom, a backup a mile from the Golden Gate Bridge. Caltrans closed down the Golden Gate Bridge except for one little lane. They closed the entire bridge so 6 overtime grifters can work on the far end of the bridge on a pothole. The entire bridge, all the whole right, 3 lanes on the right closed down. A CHP car, cones, like mayhem. You couldn't get over the bridge. It was a nightmare. It was like the movie Z after a political assassination. With backups. The only thing is in the Bay Area, no one blows their horn. They're all like afraid that they'll be arrested by a black helicopter. trapped, just trapped, a nightmare. Took me 30 minutes to get to the toll booth and another 30 minutes over the bridge. I don't even want to go into the city anymore. It's become so bad. Beautiful in there to see everybody eating and drinking. Where do they get the money from? Where does everyone get the money? The restaurants are jammed. Everyone's guzzling, drinking, online, beating each other up for clams. I want my oysters. I want my mussels. I want my... I never saw anything like it. It's phenomenal. Where's the depression? Everyone in these restaurants are like booming. They like eat like there's a place down near the ferry terminal. I don't understand it. I myself hate those things. What are they? Mussels, clams, oysters. I could throw up looking at them. I used to eat oysters. I thought it was like in the Grand Central Station at an oyster place. Like when you're young, you think it's very sophisticated to have an oyster. When you actually analyze what an oyster is and where it lives and what it eats, you bust it. You don't want to eat a raw oyster. And then about 4 years ago, I went out on Highway 1 up the coast to like Nick's Cove. Oh, my God. Forget about it. I had oysters. I was sick for 3 days. It was my luck. I mean, my family ate them. They did good. I'm nothing against Nick or his cove. But you're never going to put me next to an oyster. Let's put it this way. You're never putting an oyster next to my lips again. Forget about it. Never. Never. On the whole thing of shellfish and I'm sorry. There's a lot of people listening in the shellfish business. They get mad. No more. No more. Every time I eat a shrimp, because it's all sewer shrimp. It's all coming in either from Korea or, God forbid, place in Taiwan. I don't know where they're growing them anymore. I would have been a good congressman because I could filibuster for about 18 years. Symbol shot. No, truthfully, if I was in Congress and I wanted a filibuster, they'd call me up. They'd call me Mike the filibuster. Hey, Mike, we got a problem here. The Dems, we want to filibuster them. You think you can talk for the next 3 years? Okay, no problem. Just make sure someone gives me my tea in a cup for infants, so in case I drop it, it doesn't spill into my keyboard. Well, it's a gift to be able to go on like this and keep an audience enthralled for so many years. I have a feeling this will go on for the next world. I have a feeling I'll still be talking to you from heaven. Sometimes I think it's going to end any minute now. Do you ever get that feeling? I don't know. It's awful. If you could be someone for 10 minutes and then go back to being your miserable, horrendous self that you are, who would you like? Frank in New York on WOR. Who would you like to be for 10 minutes, Frank?
One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Neil Armstrong.
You'd like to be Neil Armstrong when he's on the moon for those 10 minutes, right?
Absolutely, sir.
You don't want to be Neil Armstrong today, though, do you?
Well, no, not really.
See, that's the thing. You got to understand that the other man's life has its ups and downs, its zenith and its apogees, you know, and its perigees. So, therefore, the guy was on the... Who was the guy, the astronaut, who went to the moon and came back and had a nervous breakdown because he couldn't get along with his wife? What was his name? What was his name? I forget his name. There was an astronaut. The man... Do you, anyone know his name? Beowulf. Who was that? John McCain? No, I'm joking. No, one of the astronauts, think about the skill, the daring, the courage, the cojones, this guy, the everything, to become an astronaut, the training, the genius, the physics, the nuclear science, and goes to the moon, can handle all of that, comes back, can't live with his wife because it's too stressful, has a crack of it, winds up in a nut house. Buzz Aldrin, Americano Edwin Aldrin, 78 años, Yum dos mayores heroes. De Exploracio Espacial. I'm reading the Portuguese translation of what happened to him. He was a hero. I mean, come on. But I remember when it happened, it was said that he couldn't handle life on Earth. Then you go on the internet and like, he saw UFOs. I know that's going to trigger. There we go already. That's all I had to say. Aliens, UFOs. Chimps drag man 1/2 mile. U.S. tour guide severely bitten at South African sanctuary. Apes grab his feet and pull him on the fence. That's horrendous. Is there anything worse than being eaten, like killed by a wild animal? I can't imagine. The Romans did that. I mean, if they didn't, they threw you in the arena. They threw you in the arena to be like torn apart by a wild animal. Oh, they had some punishments. Certain crimes in Rome, they didn't do very well with. The worst thing in Rome that you could commit was killing your father. That went on quite often, if they can get away with it, because they wanted the man's estate. So killing a father in Rome was nothing. There was no morality. It was pre-Christian Rome. So knocking off your old man for his estate, they would do it. So they had to make the crime the punishment so great to protect their property that the crime for killing your father in ancient Rome, pre-Christian Rome, was the worst possible punishment imaginable. They tied you up in a sack, and in the sack they threw snakes, rats, a few other little vermin, and then they threw you into the river. That was a combo job. You got eaten alive, and you were drowning at the same time. That's a nice thought. Yeah, knowledge is power. Forget about it. I think stupidity is power. Look what it does for liberals. Symbol shot. I think ignorance is power. Knowledge is not power. Knowledge is torment. Ignorance is power. Look what it does for liberals. Symbol shot. That was good. All right, let's go to the callers. Alabama, Robert, who would you like to be for 10 minutes of their life? Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael Savage. That's who I'd like to be for 10 minutes.
What do you think you would experience in those 10 minutes?
Well, you traveled all over the world, exotic places, wrote books, you helped people, informed people. The radio show gives everybody information, and I couldn't think of anybody else.
That's very beautiful. I mean, you know, I could be cynical and sarcastic, but I won't, because I think you're a sincere man, and I don't want to puncture your vision of me. I have a very, very difficult path through life. It's still like walking on hot coals, but... you know, there's a funny thing. No matter what you achieve, you're still you. You're still dragging your carcass through the mortality of your. You know what I'm saying? You're still dragging that thing. You're still dragging that carcass through existence, and it never gets easy. That's the point, Robert. No matter what you achieve, if you're a high achiever as I am, you're still dragging yourself through reality. Nothing changes. In other words, no matter what you achieve, there's no change in your life. Do you understand what I'm saying? There's no liberation. There's no reward, per se, for that achievement. There's no reward, which is why Hollywood, to their credit, gives themselves awards day and night. This award, that award. But, I mean, if you're a loner like me, you don't get anything out of it. I mean, maybe that's what you need is an award dinner. I don't have the strength to put on an award dinner for myself the way they do in Hollywood. Let me send you a copy of whatever trickle I have. Trickle Down Tyranny. People don't want to read the book anymore. The next one will be Trickle Something Else. How about Trickle Down Trickle? Trickle Up. The book's a genius. I'm going to have to mock my own books now to get people. Trickle Up Poverty, brilliant. Explained all of Obamacare. Trickle Down Tyranny, more brilliant. The next book will be whatever. The next book is Train Tracks, coming out in October or November. Childhood Stories, no more nonfiction. Dead Man's Pants, that kind of stuff. And stuff you never heard. I wrote all new stories for the first half of the book that you never heard before.
Savage.
Dog is overt, cat is covert. That's how I define it. I like a dog because there it is. He lifts his leg, it's over with. Cat's always hiding. Cat always hides their waist. Dog is right out there. I don't like, go right out, drop, and that's it. Go out with the dog, bingo. Cat always like looks at you, like sneaks away and does it.
Savage.
I'm going down to Louisiana, honey, behind.
Another 4 years of Obama. Free guitar strings for everyone.
I'm going down to Nevada.
Going to Nevada to do some gambling. Get me a pretty girl there now. I got the travel passes from Obama. I'm going to get me one. Them girl Nevada. Oh, Louisiana. Sorry. Louisiana. I thought he said Nevada. What's down in Louisiana? That's where the refinery is that Obama doesn't want to send the oil to. you know, I was talking about the dead man's pants. So I actually wore pants that were hand-me-downs. They were not hand-me-downs. They were from Stiffs. I told you my father used to buy estates, so to speak. Estates. Poor people. You go in and buy the whole household goods. The widow wanted to get rid of the old man's junk, you know, so including the clothing. And he'd bring home the clothing. And I knew it was a killer for me. Every time he'd bring home a good pair of pants, I knew it was coming. He'd say, take a look at this fabric. I dreaded the moment when he'd say, take a look at this fabric. And he would roll out the pants on his arm like a clothing salesman. He would say, this is some fabric. We're not going to throw this out. The next thing I knew, 2 days later, they were shortened at the knee like Abbott and Costello. Not taken in the behind. And there I was. I swear there's a picture of me. But these are such shabby pants. I was going to ask you a question on the show. Which, by the way, Jerry Lewis celebrated his 86th birthday. Always been one of my... I love the guy. I love everything he's ever done since I've been a little kid. I can't believe he's 86. He survived that with the... you know, when he had the steroids and he was puffed. Remember that? He survived that. He had his party in the Friars Club. I'm not having in the Friars Club. Obviously, anyway, so here I was going to ask, poverty I was going to talk about. There is no poverty in America. You realize that. What is poverty? You know what poor is? Poor is not America today. Poor is hunger. I've tried to define what poverty is. First of all, you know there's no hunger in America. Between food stamps and government cheese, there is no hunger in America. It's a complete lie of the liberals. Poverty today is more or less gone in America. There are poor people. But most poor people live better than most middle class, lower middle class people did 100 years ago, 80 years ago, 70 years ago. So I want to ask you, if you were poor as a child, would you describe for the Savage Nation audience what your poverty really was like? What was poverty? What did it mean? I mean, we were poor. I didn't miss a meal in the sense we're poor, but I was never hungry. I was overfed. I had garbage clothing, you know, hand-me-down clothing. I lived in a tenement in the Bronx, and across the street I thought it was paradise because there were roses growing on a fence. But I look at it now with pictures of it. There was like it was a, you know, littered, garbage-strewn lot. You know what I'm saying? I can still smell the ailanthus plants, if you know what those are, walking through the woodlot. We'd play jungles and trail each other. I remember they set a kid on fire. Oh, there were some bad kids in that neighborhood. One of them wound up shot to death. He became a Hell's Angel. The other one was... his brother died in an electric chair. I won't even mention their names. They were really mean. But there was a kid in the neighborhood with red hair, and for some reason they picked on him, and they tied him to a tree. I remember to this day. And they started dancing around him, going, and they started a fire at his feet. They tried to set him on fire until his father came running, or a neighborhood man ran out and put the fire out and chased the kids away. They were nuts. You talk Lord of the Flies. It was amazing. So I'd be curious, if you were poor, I'd like to hear what poverty really was like, because I don't think anyone knows what poverty is in America. Today you think poverty is, oh, I only have a house and I don't have a country house. Or we're poor because what? What's about? Most people are not really that poor. What is poverty? I would like to hear, and I'd like to spend one segment from you, the audience, the Savage Nation, for a moment. It's not political at all. It's not going to be to bash this one, lift up that one. Now, if I say Ryan, you know, Ryan's budget plan, most people don't even know who he is. Oh, yeah, that young fella, Ryan, he has a very nice, he has a nice game show. I know, I like that Ryan. He's a good guy. No, we're talking about an actual congressman with a plan that has about as much chance to succeed as I do of having my book appear on Fox News, Trickle Down Theory. He has as much. So, were you poor as a child? Florida, Judy, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
I have to disappoint you. I came from a comfortable family.
Thank God.
Yeah, well.
I wanted to be comfortable because I remember when I hear my parents discussing other people's income, which everyone did, by the way, behind closed doors. They would whisper and say they're very comfortable. I didn't know what that meant was. I knew we weren't. That's all I knew.
No, we never worried because my dad was a successful attorney.
Oh, a lawyer in those days was as close to God as you can get?
Judge, when he died, and he was very well thought of.
He was a judge? A judge? A judge, a jury, and an executioner. Hold on, we're going to take your story in a moment. If you were poor, tell us about it on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now,
America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I just went down to Starbucks before the show to nail myself up for the cross. I had to get the nails. I had to get the hammer. In fact, I needed it so badly, I got the nail gun. I got the caffeine and sugar nail gun for this show. I went down to Starbucks, and I asked for my usual. A small coffee, I brought my own cup. I don't like styrofoam or plastic, whatever they give it in. So I get it. And I asked for the fruit cup. He said, we're out of it. I said, thank God, give me the oatmeal cookie. Gave me the oatmeal cookie, very bad for my blood sugar. The doctor will kill me. Before I even filled up the cup, I was eating the cookie. But the fact of the matter is, I needed the fuel. So I'm armed to the teeth right now. I'm armed for Armageddon on the Savage Nation. I am so high on caffeine and sugar. I am so jammed up on oatmeal cookie and cholesterol and butter. And I can prove it. My left leg went out on the way back up in the elevator. Immediately, I reacted to the dairy. But that's the price I pay for you. So as I crucify myself today on the Savage Nation with exposure, with making more enemies than I can possibly deal with in 14 lifetimes simply by saying, hello, infidels, I am here for you. And so as I'm coming back up to the studio in the elevator here to do my show, I'm slurping the coffee. I already devoured the cookie before I hit the elevator. I eat them once a month, but the leg goes out immediately from the butter, the dairy. Instantly, I can feel it. It's like I cheated in New York and had pizza on like 81st Street and 1st Avenue. Unbelievable. My God, it was so good. It was so good. The dough was better. Maybe it's the tum water from the Hudson River. I don't really know. But the pizza was certainly better than the best pizza I ever had in my life, by the way, was years ago in Marblehead, Massachusetts, made by Greeks, incidentally. Don't call me about pizza. I won't take your call. The point is I ate the pizza. I knew what would happen. I hobbled home. Within 5 minutes, my right leg went out. Why? I react to dairy. I don't eat it because I know there's going to be a reaction. But why is it that everything that we know is everything we love does something bad to us? Why? Nothing changes. Nothing's new under the sun. Nothing is new under the sun. When I was a kid, there were finished basements in Queens in the houses, right? Finished basement. Meaning if you were not as rich as the guy next to you, you had an unfinished basement. It was dank. It was dark. It was horrible. All you did was hang laundry in it and chase the mice. But if you were rich, you paneled it with knotty pine. You put in a fake bar. You had Seagram's Royal. You had Crown Royal. And four little bottles of whiskey to show you are really wild, you know. But they had signs behind the bar, little sayings, and one of them was, "Why everything I like is illegal, immoral, or fattening." As a kid, I didn't know what that meant, because I didn't do anything illegal, I didn't do anything immoral, and I didn't do anything that was fattening. But now that I'm a man, I see the wisdom in that sign. Symbol shot, bang. 1-800, I'm not feeling bad. I hope you're feeling good. What should I do? This is it. This is it. This is the shot. This is life. Deal with the deck of cards. You got the deck, you got the four aces, or you got the four bad aces, you got the four bad hands. The other guy has the good hand, you have the bad hand. Keep playing cards. Keep playing cards. That's the whole game. Eventually, you're going to win. The odds are in your favor. If you're right and they're wrong, if you're the little guy and they're the big guy, you'll beat their behind. I got high energy when I'm on the show, right? The object is to keep you listening. So I'm talking, I'm loud, I'm this, I'm sharp, I'm not sharp, but I'm talking. I got you magnified, rarefied, agoraphobic. And then you get a caller, and he falls off the cliff. You know, Mike, I was telling you, I was listening to the things, and then you got to recognize Pelosi, but she doesn't know Rice. Right away, half the listenership goes to another station. Meanwhile, you're listening here as a guy who's running the show. You're scratching the table. Your toes are scratching against the bottom, eating the tongue of your shoe out, waiting for the guy to make a point. And you don't want to cut them off and look like a motley crew. You don't know what to do. That's why it's tough to take a call in talk radio. You understand? People misinterpret you. They think, oh, you cut the caller off. The guy was killing the show. I'm a professional. I make you listen. They don't know how to make you listen. It's a technique. It's not just what I'm saying. I'm using all sorts of hypnotic devices on you. Voice tricks that I never learned. Sonorous tricks that I never learned. Stentorian tricks I never learned. vocal tricks I never learned, but I'm using them because they're embedded in my DNA going back to the time of ancient Jerusalem. And that's why I say to you, call. So let us see now what's in the news. I'm going to get off the ecological, the eco trick. I was going to call this right after the show, the eco cleaner. I looked up a green cleaner during the I looked up a green cleaner. I love they give you a lecture. Like everything green is a lecture, comes with a lecture. We are not business people capitalizing on the green movement. And then they give you a whole story. According to the EPA, there are two different systems that are friendly to the environment. Eco, dry clean, wet clean. And then we use CO2, which uses compressed liquid carbon dioxide with detergents. Others claim to be green, but according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, by the way, a radical group, a more radical group than the Union of Concerned Scientists doesn't exist. They're all commie nuts. Every one of them are commie nuts. It's like been 1 minute, to them it's been 1 second to midnight since 1951. They've been waiting for the bomb to go off and wipe us off the planet. That didn't work, so they were waiting for the global warming racket to wipe us off the planet. That didn't work, now they're waiting for the Mayan calendar to explode and tilt the Earth around in December. The Union of Concerned Scientists, that'll be the next thing. Give money to Al Gore so the Mayan calendar doesn't make certain that you give money to the anti-Mayan calendar fund and the fund, P.O. Box Al Gore. That if you send it, do you know that the Earth is about to reverse itself on its axis? But I, Al Gore, would tell you it's a terrible thing if the Earth reverses itself. You'll all fall off the planet. So I have the answer. If all of you would lose 12 pounds and stop using Chrysler products, the Earth will not tilt on its axis, but I need your help. Only you can help me, because I have real enemies, those evil Republicans, those evil coal burners, those evil oil drillers. They want the Earth to tilt on the axis. Those evil Republicans want crippled children to be more crippled. They want everybody to die. They want the Earth to tilt. So I, Nancy Pelosi, tell you, give us money to stop the Mayan calendar from coming to effect. We Democrats will prevent the December event that is predicted on National Geographic to occur any moment from not occurring. You must lose 12 pounds and sell and send $12 to Nancy Pelosi this minute. I'm counting on you. Just add water. Nightmares all night, and it was horrible, horrible. My ancestors were appearing. It was like a Chagall painting in my head. And here's what I woke up to this song.
Joe en Paul, dat stoort een paar kieken, brabrilla Joe en Paul, dat werd je bully krieken, brabrilla zoet, hij koot, hij giet een zolle perfect, hij veegt een dapje, kuiven, naar bij Joe en Paul.
I play that just to get the crypto Nazis crazy. I mean, I do. I play it just to get the crypto Nazis who think that it's all over to recognize that it's not all over. No. You know, it's the Mayan calendar, man. It's the internal Mayan calendar. Isn't it? You remember the book from the late, the early 70s, The Teachings of Don Juan? Does anyone remember that? Raise your hand. I got a lot of old hippies who listen to this show. I'm from that age, so a lot of ex-hippies who were liberals, who think they're not now, are really actually still liberal. Because the libertarianism that you think you reflect and the conservatism that you reflect is actually true liberalism. The other side, the Obama, Pelosi, that side, they're actually fascists. They're everything that you fought against as a liberal. That's why you've become a conservative. You haven't changed your politics. So in those days, there was a book, The Teachings of Don Juan, right? And it was about a Mexican curandero who said, death stalks us. Death is with us. In other words, death is always with us. Everywhere you go, there it is, sitting in a chair. I've been that way since I'm five. Since five, how you doing? How are you today? Not bad. You got gas? How come? What'd you eat? Don't know. Bad night. I killed 32 people in Oakland last night. I don't feel good. I didn't like it. How are you? Not bad. I can't get my pants clean. This is death talking to you. Try to get my pants clean. I don't know, the uniform. You gave me the red uniform. I don't know. I can't get it cleaned. I put it in an eco cleaner. Death. You have like a conversation with death every day. It stank. Look, I may be the devil, but the fact is I need clean clothes. And you can't get a cleaner today. Nah, I understand. So what'd you eat? You have something good? Yeah, I'm a bad Indian. I have gas today. I don't understand it. But the teaching of Don Juan taught us that death is with us. It's always there, right? You get used to it. Do you believe that or not? That's a big topic.
Savage.
Right? can't wait till the train set arrives. The Pennsylvania Berkshire train comes with a powerful 284 Berkshire and the new Lionel fast freight set. Pulls an impressive number of cars. A four-bay hopper hauling coal. A flat car with generators chained to the deck. A one-of-a-kind Pennsy power and light tank car and a colorful porthole caboose. In addition to a powerful 80-watt transformer, the set includes all the fast track needed to make a deluxe figure eight a layout. I don't know. It seems to me like more fun than buying a new car. More fun than my boat. You know, I don't know what it is. Who knows? Maybe I just want to withdraw into my own imagination. Who knows? You know, I've given up watercolors. I can't do them. I have no talent whatsoever. Sad. I mean, I have the whole set that I got in Florida and I was painting. You know, at a certain point, you got to realize what you can do and what you can't do. And I've known for years what I can't do. I cannot play a musical instrument. I cannot paint. So why must I do it? Why do I have to improve myself, I ask myself? Why can't I just have a couple of drinks and watch television at night? After, I mean, I'm writing two books. I'm doing a daily radio show. I walk a dog. I mean, how much more does a man have to do? I ask myself every day. And yet, we live in a country where every man thinks he has to improve himself until the day he takes his last breath. For what? Who's watching? What am I trying to prove? Who's looking at me? He is looking at you, kid. Anyway, here we are in the Savage Nation. We're talking about very important things and very insignificant things. And so if you care to join the conversation, the phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Or you can do what I'm going to do right now. I want to go to michaelsavage.com and I want to see what's up there because I work on it from the morning. I get up. I actually love getting up. Actually believe I actually enjoy getting up. The first thing I do with you, but what do I do the first thing I get up? I do push-ups. That's the first thing I do most days. Lately, I haven't been wanting to do them, but I do them most days. I hate it. I hate doing push-ups. I hate them. It's worse than cod liver oil when I was six. And then I do some barbell work for the arms because, I mean, there's nothing worse in a man than a soft arm. Well, okay, we'll leave it at that. But you see, there's medication for the other problem. There's no medication to make your biceps hard. You can't take a pill and make your biceps hard, can you? That you have to do the good old-fashioned way with dumbbells. With regard to the other part of your anatomy, you know, you could be lazy and you could still be, right? So I do the dumbbells. The next thing I do is I stumble into the kitchen. Well, I walk into the kitchen. I got to let the dog out into the yard. Then there's another dog I have to let out in the yard, the other maniac. I pray to God he didn't leave me a surprise by the door. The Havanese with Teddy. Oh, what a mess that is. God, housebreaking a dog. Don't get me started. Never again. No more. I love them. They're like people. But at a certain point, I mean, you know, my father knew how to housebreak a dog. I got to tell you, this new age housebreaking doesn't work. You spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars with techniques, and it doesn't work. My father, rest his soul, knew how to housebreak Tippy. He did it in exactly two training sessions, and he never studied it. You see, it consisted of rolling up the Daily News, and at the first sign of a dog dumping in your living room, he took the dog's face and rubbed it in it, and smacked him on the butt and screamed at him as loud as he could, and said, "Don't ever do that again." And then rubbed his face in it again and hit him again. That was the housebreaking, and it worked. Now the therapy and the call PETA, and you're liable to make them into an erotic peer if you yell at it. It didn't make him into an erotic peer. He never peed in the house again, ever. Never. He never lifted a leg again. Well, it did once on Fat Al's foot, I got to admit. But that was a special occasion. When the 400 pounder sat in the living room, I told you that story. I don't want to get into a childhood story. God, why were men so colorful in those days? Where have they all gone? Why are men so bland with shorts today? Everybody turns to like bland suburban white men with no personality. Everyone's in perfect shape. They're thin. They bicycle. They row. They exercise. They eat right. They have a cereal for breakfast and they're bland as a toastie without honey cream on it. I don't understand it. Where are all of the wild differences in people that used to exist? And that goes back to the movie I watched over the weekend. I got to drift into the movie again. I got to tell you about it before we forget it. And before we get into the whole train set, Dagon, atomic war is coming. Obama blocks Texas voter ID law, needs illegals to stay in power. Clear as a bell to me. Before we get into all of that stuff. Honest to God, that movie, it just stuck in my mind. I'm searching for a movie. I hit Turner Classic Movies. Thank God someone collected all of these movies. They're amazing. And they reissued a movie from 62
called Mafioso. I happen to love the genre. So this is a black and white, low-budget production, and it takes place in Milano to start with. It's a Sicilian man who's a factory manager who is married to a blonde lady, a Nordic, and he has two lovely little daughters. And he's going home to Sicily for a two-week holiday to visit his parents because his wife has... He left Sicily to better his life, which he did. He's a factory manager. And he's going to go home to visit his parents because she never met them. Before he leaves, I'm not going to give away the plot, he's called into the room of the factory boss who says to him, I want you to deliver a package to Don so-and-so in the town in which you're going back to. He said, we both come from the same town in Sicily. I want you to visit Don Pedro, and I want you to give him this package, and you got to deliver it to him personally. So you know already there's a plot line that's going to be followed. Now, this movie is if you look it up on IMDb, it's a comedy. They say it's a comedy drama, which is very interesting. It's not a comedy drama. It's a drama, but it's lighthearted. Because he's a lighthearted character. He's one of the greatest Italian character actors of his time. Now, if you like black and white movies, which I do, I love it. I always loved Ilia Kazan. These scenes, again, in the Sicilian town where he goes home, where the food scenes alone are worth watching this movie. But wait, before I go, before I stop talking about the movie, I don't know why I'm going on and on about it. There's another scene in here. I don't know how to say it to you without giving the plot away. There's about a 7 or 8 minute scene, maybe a 10 minute scene in New York, in Manhattan. Manhattan, circa 1960. The Manhattan I remember. The Manhattan when I was young. The Manhattan that no longer exists. And those scenes of driving down Fifth Avenue in an open Cadillac convertible and some of the seedier hotels and whatnot are astonishing in their documentary quality and the graphic nature of the film and how it evolves, okay? So for those reasons alone, I highly recommend this movie. And I don't even have anything to do with any of the people. They're probably not even around anymore.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
You know, in a recent article in the Smithsonian magazine, I was reading about an archaeologist, Richard Hansen, who's made some pretty fascinating discoveries in Guatemala, which changes what we thought we knew about the Mayan civilization. He now joins us to talk about what he's found. Richard Hansen, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on. It's been I've been listening to your show off and on over the years, and I appreciate a lot of your position. So thank you for the opportunity.
Please tell my audience what you've been doing.
Well, what I've been doing for the last 33 years is exploring a remote and isolated area of northern Guatemala. We call it the Mirador Basin because it's an area of water kind of collects and stagnates in a series of seasonal swamps. And in this remote, isolated, roadless area, we have discovered the largest ancient Maya cities in the Western Hemisphere. Not only that, but the unique concentration of these big cities are found there, and the architecture is up to 1,000 years earlier than other areas of the Yucatan Peninsula or Guatemala or Mexico. As a result, it's been a fascinating foray into the origins of Maya civilization, looking at the very beginning of this complex and unique society in the Western Hemisphere, and to such the extent that we've discovered what may be and what appears to be the largest ancient pyramids in the world are found there, in terms of volume, not in height, but in terms of volume. So it's a unique area in its own ecological and cultural frame that was known anciently as the Khan Kingdom, and it is found now in northern Guatemala.
How did this discovery occur? It sounds like a pretty remote area.
Well, there's no roads into this area, so as a result, it's been neglected because it's hard to get into. Even the Spanish, when they came down in 1695, avoided these seasonal swamps because they're hard to travel through. They're spiny. There's noxious trees and a lot of snakes and other crocodiles and other formidable hazards. So they've invited Eric Kim on the west side of this system to get down to the last capital of the Maya, which was in Lake Petén Itzá. But in 1930, there was an aerial expedition from the University of Pennsylvania that flew over this area, and they thought what looked like volcanoes as they were flying from Campeche, Mexico, over to Chetumal. And they thought, it's odd that in a karstic limestone area we'd have volcanoes. So they flew out of their way to take a look at it and discovered that they were not volcanoes at all, but massive pyramids and concentrations of these pyramids. So then it wasn't until 1962 that a scholar from Harvard named Ian Graham went out there and spent a few days mapping a portion of the cities. And then I got in on the action in 1978 when I was working in Tel Aviv University in Israel, and was invited to come join a project organized by Catholic University and Brigham Young University, and at an area called Mirador. They were primarily interested in the swamps, but since I had experience in architecture, they assigned me the large architecture, and I discovered the antiquity of the extremely large architecture there, which was 1,000 years earlier than what it's supposed to be. And the rest is history. I've got stuck in Guatemala now for 33 years.
Has this changed our view of the Mayans, and why does that matter to us?
Well, primarily the pre-classic periods, or the periods before the time of Christ, were considered to be the hunters and gatherers and primitive development. In 1922, the Carnegie Institution found a structure at the site of Washaktun that was 8 meters high, and it was a pre-classic structure. And, of course, since there were no other buildings like this, they figured, my gosh, we found the pinnacle of Maya social and economic complexity before the time of Christ at 8 meters high. Little did they know that just a little bit to the northwest, if they'd have just kept moving out there, they would have found pyramids 72 meters high that were dating to the same period or even earlier. And so when we came across this unusual phenomenon, what it did is it changed our entire perspective of the development of Maya civilization. Now, there's only 5 civilizations in the world that we would call a founding civilization, and that means that they developed written script. You have the Chinese, you have the Indus Valley of Pakistan and India, you have the Mesopotamians, the Egyptians, and then the Mesoamerican societies, the Maya in particular. These are the only societies in the world that developed an independent original script. And that makes the Mayas one of the great civilizations of the world. And now we're discovering their true florescence occurred centuries before the time of Christ in what we think was the first state-level society, economically and politically, in the Western Hemisphere.
Well, just how large is this site?
Well, it's not just one site. We've now mapped and excavated in 51 ancient cities in the basin. I've only worked at the big one, of course, is El Mirador. But the other cities that we've explored now, mapped and excavated and put test pits in and excavated architecture and salvaged information from, now numbers 51 cities. I would guesstimate, that there are probably another couple hundred cities out there that need mapping and exploration. It's a little bit harsh. You're in a tropical forest. You can go within 10 feet of a 50 meter building and not see it. So it's dense tropical forest, and it's unique in the sense that we have species that are endemic only to that area. Michael, I know that you've got a tremendous interest in ethnobotany, and we have unique species of plants that are only found in this area that are extremely interesting pharmaceutical values. We have identified 14 new species of moth, for example, that don't exist anywhere else in the world. We found 2 species of birds that are endemic to the basin. We don't find any in the rest of Guatemala. So these kind of things, which we all bring into the disciplines, we use all these different disciplines in our research now so that we get a vision of the entire story. We want the purpose of this is to understand the story that happened there, why the tremendous fluorescence of societies. When the rest of the Maya world were living in little huts, these guys were building, pyramids 55 to 72 meters high. what is it that prompts that kind of behavior? What are the factors that allow you to become complex? What are the factors that allowed you to maintain that extraordinary dynamic? And what are the factors that take you to hell, so to speak? What are the factors that make you collapse? And when we look at that through the window of archaeology, we can see the beginning, the dynamics, the collapse of a civilization. And that's what makes it fascinating.
What do you think caused the Mayan civilization to collapse?
Well, what we've identified are two collapses. We have a collapse that occurred about 150 A.D., and we have another collapse that occurred about 900 A.D. The one that everybody's identified is the one that about 900 A.D. But we identified the major collapse about 150 A.D., and there are numerous factors involved. If it was a monocausal factor or just a single factor, we would have identified it long ago. But there's numerous processes and numerous factors that involved. Not the least of which was evidence of a substantial drought, substantial hardship, 2 to 3 years without any rain whatsoever, that would have put the societies in a precarious position to feed, especially large societies. A city with 200,000 people and no food is a problem. But what we really identified is that the factors that make you great in the first place have to be respected and maintained. And if you violate those principles, if you neglect those concepts, it has huge consequences down the pike.
Exactly.
In this case, the Maya developed extraordinary sophistication because they were using mud from the swamps and dragging that mud by the thousands of tons into their cities and building extraordinarily agricultural complexes. But what happened is that we find evidence of that dark organic swamp mud buried under 2 to 3 meters of sterile clay. So I had to understand, what was it that would create that kind of sedimentation, especially when we knew that there were drought scenarios. And what we discovered is that there was a real consumption of wood to make lime cement. Now, it takes a huge amount of wood and a huge amount of limestone. You have to burn that to create the process that creates lime, a quick lime. And then when you hydrate that again with water, it has a violent reaction, but it makes a cement that can be molded and shaped. And they plastered their cities, they plastered their buildings, they plastered their plazas, they plastered their causeways, their superhighways, and essentially developed extraordinarily complex society. But they went to what we call conspicuous consumption, meaning that they started laying thick floors that had no need of being there. Instead of a 10-centimeter thick floor, they were now laying floors 20, 30, 40 centimeters thick. Well, why do you need a floor like that? Outside in your office there, Michael, I'm sure you don't need a 10-foot thick sidewalk. But they were doing it. And why? Because they could. And this is where we have a kind of, and it cost them dearly, because once they stripped all that that wood, what we did is we sent a team from Berkeley all over the Maya of Mesoamerica, documented lime production systems. How much wood does it take? How much stone does it take to make how much lime? So they stripped their forest. When the rains did occur, it washed freely down into those agricultural swamps and buried that rich organic mud under meters of sterile clay. And boy, when you can't feed your population, you are in trouble. And, the messages of the past are huge messages for today. We've got to pay attention to the lessons of the past, because they have huge implications for what the decisions that we make today.
Richard Hansen, this is amazing detective work. Thanks for being with us on the Savage Nation.
It's been interesting to see and listen to all the great things that you have done over your lifetime too. Not often you get a talk show host with a PhD in any kind of degree. So I've appreciated the great things you've done over your life too.
I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Thank you. stunning round grind.
Go Nevada. Go Nevada.
I know I don't
I got the Obama travel stamp. Oh, we got the government travel stamp for Nevada. Harry Reid, invite us. Give me a woman there. Government woman, government woman, government woman. Gonna give me a government woman there. I got a travel stamp. Ooh, I got a love stamp from Obama. Give me a free love in Nevada. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. You can see what mood I'm in. I'm a very resilient man. I bounced back today for some reason. Some would call it manic depression, but it isn't. It's called a human being who feels things. And, you know, I'm starting to, I actually feel the news. It starts to get to me like it's personal. And I have to be very careful. That's why today is a little different. So I'm talking about poverty. I'm talking about your poverty, my poverty, his poverty. And I'm... My point is, what was your poverty like if you grew up poor? Let America really know, because you're going to tell stories today on this show that might shock people who don't realize what poverty really is. So let's go to the first caller. You're all invited to join the parade, 1-800-449-8255. Sacramento, Roger, go ahead, please. You grew up poor. Tell us what it was like.
Yes, Dr. Savage. When Pop would buy us one pair of shoes a year, and it had to last all the way through the school year, when the soles ran out, we had to take cereal boxes and cut cardboard, put it in our shoes until Pop was ready to buy us another pair of shoes. Holes in our jeans, Mom would put patches, and if we...
Wait a minute, you sound awfully similar to Governor Jerry Brown. Are you the governor just having fun with me?
No, sir, this is...
Come on, I'm just... No, you sound like Jerry Brown, being you're calling from Sacramento. Come on, Roger, seriously, you actually put cardboard in your shoes?
I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, in a steel town, 1943. Grew up...
Oh.
40s and 50s, and my dad was a hard-working man, and I think he was trying to teach us a lesson on taking care of the things that were given to us.
Uh-huh. Well, I did the same. In other words, I lined the shoes. I had more than one pair of shoes, but I lined them up under my bed, and I kept them polished. Would you believe it? I've always been the same, very fanatic about taking care of my things ever since I grew up with so little. I took care of what I had. It's very interesting, isn't it?
That's how I learned. That's how I learned.
And no, it's funny. Even though, let's say, you grow older and you get a little successful and you have money, I still won't leave lights on in the house. And people laugh at me. They say, what are you turning off lights for? What, are you cheap? You know what my answer is? I don't know. It's just in me. Why not turn a light bulb off if you're not in the room? Why must it be on? Do you still do a thing like that?
Well, the audience won't believe me, but I do. I do. I'm sitting in my house. It's cold right now. I have the heat turned off. I have my water.
I love it. Well, I don't like heat to begin with. It dries me out. They think that they're living like in the Russian Revolution with me. They think it's like Dr. Zhivago in my house. I'd rather walk around like with a coat on in the house than run heat. Not to save money. I don't like heat. It makes me feel sick. So you really grew up that poor, but you did okay later on, or you're still poor?
Well, I'm doing better now. I've learned how to invest. I lived in a travel trailer for 19 years of my life and just got into a little house. I'm starting to save money, but the government seems to be wanting to take a lot of it away, so I'm kind of stripping back into the financial situation I was.
Uh-oh, not good. Yeah, but you're never going to go back to that level of poverty of putting cardboard in your shoes. Thank you very much for sharing. 1-800-449-8255. No, here's a caller. You're not going to believe this. Ann Arbor, Mish. Rick, welcome to the Savage Nation. Tell us your poverty story.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was born in the 50s, and my father moved around a lot. We lived in tents, and actually back then the tents didn't have bottoms in them, so when it rained, we had to dig ditches around the tent to keep from washing out.
That is amazing. This is almost like the Grapes of Wrath. You say you moved around. Were they itinerant workers or what?
They just moved from factory to factory, but we still had food. We still had government food. We had government cheese. We had government milk. We had the government meat. You know, we didn't have food stamps, but we still had food.
So in that sense, you have to say thank God the government distributed excess food. I mean, you have to agree with that, right?
We go to food banks, you know.
But I'm saying that what I'm saying, there is a place for government assistance. I'm not one of these fanatics who say there should be no government help for the poor. I mean, people would starve to death. Don't you think, Rick?
Can't really say we were poor because we still had food in our
stomach. I'm saying A, he's saying B. But Rick, wouldn't you agree with me that there's a role for the government in assisting people who are poor?
Right. If there's no means, if they have no means.
That's correct. And if they're not able-bodied and they can't find work, you got to help people. You can't let them starve to death. See, that's why I say I'm an independent conservative. I don't take this hard line, oh, let them find a job, let them go out and create a business. That's such rubbish. There's no way to do that in some cases. Absolutely no way whatsoever. Well, I'm glad that, you know, this is turning into a very good topic, by the way. But, you know, what is a vacation, you know, when you were poor? Think about that. We had, we lived in the apartment. My father always had a car because he needed it for his business to go down to Manhattan to his little store to make deliveries. One of my books I wrote, The Look Come Out, when he delivered the bronzes out there to the guy with the one breast, you know, the circus, half man, half woman. That's a heck of a story. To believe these things existed, but they did. So we had an apartment and a car, but nothing else, you know. Dead man's pants, but I never wanted for a meal, and I never felt poor. See, that's the point I'm trying to make. I'm trying to make a point is that most kids don't even know they're poor. If they have the security of parents and friends and some family around and they eat, they're not poor. They don't know poverty. It's like a Sajat Ray movie, if you know what I'm referring to. The old movies, the films about poverty in India. In many ways, I used to relate to those movies because those lives were very rich. There's a lot of richness, by the way, in poor neighborhoods and a lot of poverty in rich neighborhoods. You've heard that? Because you know what I'm talking about.
Savage.